Yeah, it occurred to me looking at the title, what was I thinking when I wrote that title? And obviously it was, I was thinking, I wasn't sure what I was going to talk about at the conference. So the experiments that I'm going to describe to you are all motivated at trying to understand geophysical and astrophysical flows such as occur in the Earth's outer core. And of course the Earth's outer core is quite remote from us at the crust, and so we have relatively limited knowledge of the details of the state of flows and fluctuations inside, but one can hope to build experiments that have realistic amounts of turbulence and where rotation is significant and Lorentz forces are significant, and try to understand about those flows. And I guess over the years I've become progressively more embarrassed to stand up and give talks like this, realizing that I'm not the one actually performing the experiments, but just sort of wandering through the lab dispensing what serves as wisdom in the lab, and giving far too much advice that could ever be followed, I guess, in any one graduate student lifetime. But the experiments I'm going to tell you about in liquid helium and liquid nitrogen and water were performed by Greg Bewley and Matt Paletti. And then the team sodium is over here, which includes Dan Sisson, who's graduated now postdoc at Georgetown University, and Doug Kelly is currently working to finish his dissertation on the 60 centimeter sodium experiment, and Dan Zimmerman in Santiago Triana on the 3 meter system. So Santiago's here, Santiago, okay, and Doug is also here, Doug. So Don Martin is our Uber technician who tries to keep the place not on fire and intact at any given moment. So I had a shorter variation on the title here, which is instabilities in liquid sodium, nitrogen, water, or helium. And the or is an important thing here because it's probably inadvisable to be mixing all of these together in the lab. At least there are some incompatibilities there in different temperature regimes as well. I should without a doubt point out the very generous and kind support both of the University of Maryland where we are and the National Science Foundation. So the work I'm going to tell you about today actually almost all stems out of four particular publications. So I'm actually going to start here middle left and in my own left-handed way progress counterclockwise through these papers. So this particular paper talks about inertial waves and grid turbulence in the physics of fluids from 2007, which is part of Greg Bewley's dissertation work. Then actually a closely intellectually related work on inertial waves but in a spherical geometry with Doug Kelly as the first author. And these two actually lead to a single hypothesis at the end, which I'll share with you and we might discuss over the next few days. I'm going to tell you a bit about the experimental work we've been doing in superfluid helium at 2K, and in particular to advance an idea which is not necessarily original to myself, but that quantized vortices can be thought of as interesting models for high magnetic Reynolds number magnetic field lines, and how one might think about what's happening in the limit of infinite magnetic Reynolds number can be modeled in some sense by superfluid flows. And then finally talk about a realization of an experiment that shares many hallmarks with the Velikov instability or magnetorotational instability, also in liquid sodium. So starting out then with these grid turbulence experiments, the experiments were done in a cryogenic apparatus, so the working volume was just a rectangular prism. And in this case, we had liquid nitrogen or liquid helium. And the original question that Greg Bewley set out to understand was that if you pull a grid from one end to the other in a initially quiescent fluid, you set up a turbulent flow. The turbulence decays. And this has been studied over a long time to understand the power law decay of the energy in turbulence. But Greg set out to understand if you set up a globally rotating quiescent fluid and then pull the grid of course is rotating with the entire apparatus, how does the turbulence decay? And Greg was dead set from the onset of the project to try and understand how the power law exponent might change with global rotation. And I'll show you that he had to somewhat abandon that particular hypothesis partway through the work. And in fact, he became so distressed at what he saw in the liquid nitrogen and liquid helium experiments that he set up a water experiment in a cylinder and came to the same conclusion in water where it was quite unambiguous of what you can see. And basically what he saw was that if you look at PIV measurements of two components of the velocity in a small volume, within it using particle image velocimetry, then in the non-rotating case, the average kinetic energy decays monotonically and quite close to a power law with exponents which are similar to what's been found, minus 1.1, let's say, 1.2. But if you do the same in the rotating case, one has local systematic oscillations in the kinetic energy in this subset of the volume, and that moreover, these are coherent from experiment to experiment. So in fact, this curve is the average of many dozens of single poles of the grid. So there are phase coherent oscillations that are set up in this, and I think you can see these if I show you experimental data. So this is the non-rotating case, and the turbulence is decaying, and one gets eddies and winds, and oh, it all looks a bit turbulent without very much explicit structure. But in the rotating case, on the right-hand side here, if you watch the velocity field, you can see a bit of a sloshing motion, which is quite evident. And again, the sloshing movement has a certain amount of coherence from run to run in the experiments, and actually eventually a two-dimensionalization, as you might expect for very late times in the flow. So, of course, what Greg wanted was a power law exponent out of this, and what he found was oscillations, and after about a year of trying to get rid of the oscillations, I convinced Greg, maybe you should be studying the oscillations instead of trying to force-fit power laws on clearly oscillatory data. And when he finally turned to what was actually happening rather than to what he wanted to happen in the experiment, what he discovered, of course, was that he had a populated state of inertial modes, and I'll just run through the simple analysis. So if we take Navier-Stokes in the rotating frame, where we've absorbed centrifugal acceleration into the pressure, we still have this Coriolis term, and the standard argument goes that if the Reynolds number is large, viscosity is unimportant. And if the Rossby number is small, the nonlinear term, so we'll drop that. Usually when people drop the nonlinear term, they drop the time derivative term too. And while it hasn't been said, I suspect many of the numerical simulations we've seen so far this week have dropped the time derivative term as well, although I guess that was never explicitly, the equations were not always presented, and so it was somewhat hard to deduce what was being simulated. If you do that, of course, you end up just with a balance of Coriolis and pressure, and one curl later find the Taylor-Proudman theorem that things are independent of a rotation axis. Now, if you don't drop the time derivative term, and then take that same curl, one finds that this quantity is not zero, but is the time derivative of the vorticity. And that then forms a linear wave equation, which has plane wave solutions in free space, with a very interesting dispersion relation, but moreover, if you put them in a container, you get modes of the container, which are inertial modes, for which Rossby waves are a special case of inertial waves for a particular planetary thin shell. And so what Greg found was, in fact, these inertial modes were what replaced three-dimensional turbulence when you rotate the experiments. So rather than just getting broadband turbulence, one gets a wavy turbulence, as was discussed in the last session. An important aspect of these is in a container, it's been known that the quality factor of these waves scales like Ekman to the minus 1/2. And in fact, then the Ekman number has to be quite low to reveal this wavy turbulence. And if you're, and in particular, if the Ekman number is not below 10 to the minus 6 in the presence of boundaries, I think one doesn't see this because all these waves are overdamped. But the experiments I'm going to tell you today are all at smaller Ekman number than that. And you can see that they're that there are inertial waves. If you look at the power spectra of this decaying, it has broad peaks, and those peaks line up with the computed modes for the rectangular or cylindrical system. And so, in fact, Leo Maas assisted us for the rectangular case. Greg did an experiment where he varied the height of the cylindrical case in water, and then these modes that he found, depending on the height, scaled exactly as one would expect for the inertial modes. And so it was quite clear that what he was seeing was an interacting collection of inertial modes is what became of the turbulence in this rapidly rotating system. Okay, so moving on then to a closely related situation, but no longer with grids and no longer in prisms, but now in a planetary geometry, we have a 60 centimeter experiment. This is just the lower half of a titanium container. With the upper half in place, we can load it with 110 kilograms of sodium. The outer sphere rapidly rotates up to close to 40 revolutions per second. The inner sphere also rapidly rotates independently, let's say plus or minus 45 hertz. Now, none of the experiments that I've done have shown dynamo action, so we've imposed external magnetic fields through the system with an external set of coils, and to a certain extent, for what I'm going to tell you in the next few minutes, just use the magnetic field as a probe of the hydrodynamics inside the system. For small magnetic fields, the magnetic field acts as a passive vector field being mixed by the velocity field. Toward the end of the talk, I'll show you what happens at larger magnetic fields, but for the time being, they'll be relatively small. We measure the magnetic field then on the outside using Hall probes and look at the time traces. And what we find is that the magnetic field that's induced by the system is very oscillatory, but shows oscillations that depend on the relative rotation rates of the inner and outer sphere. So here's a long time trace showing oscillations of the external magnetic field. This is all for, let me just move this to uncover. This is all for the outer sphere going 30 revolutions per second, and the inner sphere then varying from plus 45 to minus 45 revolutions per second. So this is a spectrogram similar to what we saw in Henri Claude's talk, where we have the power spectra at each line then is color-coded, where red are high amplitude oscillations, and here we're varying the parameter, so each line is in fact a different file at a slightly different parameter. And one sees then large amplitude oscillations, evident also in the time trace, but that the frequency of oscillation depends on where you are in parameter space, and in particular things are relatively quiet, as they must be, for perfect co-rotation, where this ratio is 1. Now, actually just as a way of understanding what this is doing, we've made a sound file by converting the magnetic field time traces into a sound. But just to find out how tiresome this is getting, who has heard this already? Okay, it must be, okay, so maybe slightly less than half. So my apologies to everybody who's heard it already and has already found it irritating. But it does give one an intuitive sense of what's happening in the magnetic fields. So again, this is just the time trace of magnetic field, sped up by a factor of 20, and turned into pressure fluctuation. And in fact, that turbulent state in the end there is representing these spectrograms at the far right, where things are actually quite banded. So most of the power is in a band here and a band here, and they're further bands. And so we actually never get to a situation where one has a continuous spectra of the sort that one expects for non-rotating cases, a never a sort of continuous Kolmogorov spectra. And so again, a second case where essentially by adding global rotation to the system, we've replaced a broadband turbulent spectra with the wavy turbulence, with these very prominent modes that have much of the power in them in the turbulent state. And I guess this is all at Reynolds number of 10 to 50 million, and so the hydrodynamic Reynolds numbers are really quite large in this case. Now, it turns out if you look at the pattern of the magnetic field, here's polar angle, azimuthal angle, each of these different modes has a very well-defined pattern of the magnetic field. Here, blue being outward radial magnetic field and red being inward radial magnetic field. And at this point, you probably wouldn't be surprised to learn what they are, but let me first show you another way of viewing the data. So if you convert the experimental measurements into Gauss coefficients, one can then just render that into a movie, which basically I just studied Gary's movies and tried to think, how would I do that? And came up with some way of animating then the time series of Gauss coefficients in the end. So this is then, as probably plain, a rotating M equal 2 magnetic field pattern. It's not purely harmonic. You can see that there's some additional time dependencies beyond simple rotation, but at a Reynolds number of 10 to 50 million, one would expect a little bit of time dependence in these wave modes, because things should not be just simply purely humming the entire time. Now, with a little help from our friends, we were able to deduce what these modes were, and it turns out that each of these simple line-like modes has a one-to-one correspondence between our observed magnetic field pattern and the induced magnetic field you would expect from a low-lying whole sphere inertial mode. And so Andre Stegner set up a code by which the analytical form for these would give rise then to the induced magnetic field you would expect, and they match in terms of L, M, and frequency for at least a half a dozen modes at different parts in the parameter space. And so it's really quite clear that these are inertial modes. What's farther from clear is the driving mechanism for the modes, although it appears over rotation at a shear layer is likely playing a role. And also mode selection is something we do not understand. We only see one parity, not both, and only certain M numbers and not all. And so there's definitely things left to understand. But we still have two more papers worth of results to go through, so let me just set that aside. Doug Kelly has a poster that has more information on these different modes, and so let me just refer to that. Now, I'd mentioned this idea that you could model high magnetic Reynolds number dynamics by using liquid helium, and to be clear, the liquid sodium flows that we've done have magnetic Reynolds numbers ranging from, let's say, tens to what will be in the 3-meter system on order of 1,000. But of course, in trying to understand something like the sun or the Milky Way, these very diffuse magnetic fields perhaps are not an excellent guide for what happens when the magnetic field lines are quite close to topological in their motion. Now, it turns out that if you cool the 4 isotope of helium down below about 2.17 K, that it develops long-range quantum order, and in particular, it develops line-like vortices in the flow. And these line-like vortices are actually topological objects. If we write the order parameter, which is a complex field, as an amplitude times e to the I phi, we get vortices in the flow around which there is circulation due to a 2 pi change in phi going around the line. So they're really just phase defects, if you will, in this complex field. But in fact, they are representing the actual circulation of helium around that line with an angular momentum about the line center of h bar. Now, because they are a topological feature of the complex field, they're not like diffuse magnetic fields that we're used to, because the lines cannot be spontaneously diffused away or cannot be spontaneously created. They're really topological objects that have to grow from some seed phase defect. They can be stretched out in a way which is very familiar in thinking about magnetic fields, but they cannot be dissipated in any standard way that we're used to thinking about low Reynolds number flows. So the analogy, which actually Carlo Berenghi was the one first suggested to me, was that quantum vortices can be thought of as an interesting model for magnetic field lines. So if we think of just a frozen in field line in some ideal conducting fluid, then the normal fluid flow in the helium, which stretches these, is comparable then to the flow of the plasma these are embedded in, and then the stretching of these field lines is comparable to induction. And I guess the literature has actually made it quite clear that these vortices are good analogies in some measure to disclinations in solids and cosmic strings, and finally, highly magnetized plasmas, and that all of these systems share many similar features in their topological properties. Now, we've worked to directly visualize these by putting hydrogen ice into the system, and that ice becomes trapped on these line-like vortices, or you could think of these like magnetic field lines. So this is in a rotating state where all of the vortices want to align with the axis of rotation, although have wave modes and some collective bundling as well in the system. By far, the most interesting set of things we've seen are some difficult to explain features of the particles being uniformly spaced along the lines. But in terms of magnetic field dynamics, the way in which reconnection occurs in these vortices may give some useful insight as to intermittent reconnection for magnetic field lines. So in particular, because these are topological objects in the fluid flow, you can't just get rid of them by a diffusive process. What you can do is have them retract. But if you have a tangle of these things, they can't retract if they're knotted, in much the way that magnetic field lines would have trouble if they're knotted, unless they can reconnect, unless you can actually cross lines and then have them exchange tails, what in fact ends up unable to dissipate magnetic fields in the high magnetic Reynolds number limit. So in our case then, we have these vortices which are decorated with particles, and one can directly visualize the reconnection process as is done here. So here one can see then these dotted lines coming in and exchanging tails, and there's a line tension to the vortices, much as there should be a line tension for magnetic fields. So they spring back out of these events. And that springing motion in the reconnection leads to very interesting particle acceleration properties and power law tails of the velocity and energy distributions for these particles due to reconnection. And again, one can imagine analogies in the reconnection processes in the solar corona or elsewhere by which the reconnection gives rise to particle acceleration of charged particles just directly from a similar process. So last, but perhaps not least, were experiments where we turned up the magnetic field strength to where the magnetic field was no longer passive and Lorentz forces became significant. So this is back then to a spherical Couette flow where we have a spherical outer container, here stationary, and a rotating copper inner sphere. We found that if the external magnetic field were above some threshold, the instability set in the system from a state with background shear turbulence to a state of organized magnetic fields and increased angular momentum transport in the simplest state with a rotating equatorial dipole. So again, only above a threshold magnetic field, we started to see patterns of this sort. At higher magnetic field values or different rotation rates, one could see more complicated patterns. This is an induced magnetic field which has a very large axisymmetric component, but again, substantial fluctuations likely due to the high background Reynolds number in those flows. In thinking about these then, we looked at the phase diagram of the rotation rate put as a magnetic Reynolds number and the external magnetic field here is a Lundquist number or magnetic Reynolds number based on the Alphane velocity. And we found that the onset of this instability, these circles, agreed reasonably well with where one would expect the onset of the magnetorotational instability for our angular velocity profile. It should be clear that if we rotate our inner sphere rapidly and hold the outer sphere stationary, the angular velocity is falling with radius. So then you're ripe for having a magnetorotational instability with a sufficiently large but not too large external magnetic field. And again, these are then different domains where we saw different basic symmetry patterns within the system. Now, this was a little bit of a quandary in some sense because there were definitely similarities and differences between what we saw and what one might expect. And in particular then, let me lay out what some of those are. So the stability boundary was reasonably close to what one would expect for our angular velocity curve. It was clear from all the evidence that both centrifugal and Lorentz forces were relevant in the instability, and we also saw an increased angular momentum in the system. But our base state was turbulent. And so this is a situation where you have an already turbulent flow due to shear instabilities that developed an additional instability due to the Lorentz forces being present in the system that wouldn't be there in the absence of the conducting fluid and Lorentz instabilities. And that our first instability was non-axisymmetric. This seemed to cause the greatest distress, I guess, between expectations theoretically and what we saw in the experiments. Now, these experiments have been augmented by recent experimental runs with the 60-centimeter system. That other one was 30-centimeter, where we rotate both the outer sphere and the inner sphere. And we can do that in a way where the inner sphere is still more rapidly rotating than the outer, or even arrange it so that the rotation rate ratio is close to what one could set for a Keplerian rotation rate ratio for these spheres. Now, so Doug Kelly's been doing these experiments either with a copper inner sphere, or just in the past month, a soft iron inner sphere, as suggested by Jean-Francois. And we've done those experiments then with this external magnetic field coil, acquiring the data on Hall probes. Let me just tell you about the geometry a little bit, because it's significant for future collaborations, that we have four rings of Hall probes. So this is within which the experiment would just sit. This is with the sphere removed from the apparatus. So you can see the magnets and then Hall probe rings. And those are arranged in such a way that we can obtain all of the poloidal Gauss coefficients up to L equal 4 and the time series of those. So in a particular experiment, I think this is with a soft iron inner sphere and a Keplerian rotation rate ratio, here are time traces then of Gauss coefficients for a particular burst of magnetic activity. Again, these are all with an external magnetic field which is active, that is causing Lorentz forces in the system, and a large shift then in an octopole axisymmetric moment, and then a dipole moment arising out of that burst. And this particular burst then showed quite large changes in the orientation of that dipole part through this. This is in seconds, so this is just several second long large burst of magnetic activity. So this is what that particular magnetic field pattern looked like right toward the end of the burst, I think around second 20. One of the things I should mention, that these experiments with the soft iron inner sphere are, well, I guess we've only run maybe 4 days altogether in that configuration. And the two differences that we've seen, and this is all quite preliminary, is that the induced magnetic fields are much larger, probably an order of magnitude larger than they were for the copper inner sphere. And that the torques, or the angular momentum flux through the system, is also substantially larger than it was for a copper inner sphere. I think probably 10 to 50 times larger, depending on the parameter range we were in. And so, in fact, that actually has been causing a certain amount of experimental distress, because we just end up being torque limited in many parameter ranges and unable to independently rotate the two spheres when the magnetic field becomes so thoroughly coupled in the system. Now, I just want to comment briefly that the reason in part that we express the data in this way, and the reason in part that we transitioned from propellers to spherical Quet flow, was that Gary Glassmeyer has told me often early on that propellers were hard to simulate. And so our thinking was that by going to spherical Quet flow and expressing the data as traces of Gauss coefficients, that it would be amenable to simulations. And I'd like any of you who have spherical codes and are interested in direct comparisons between experiments and simulations, that this might give an interesting rotating MHD regime by which to make comparisons. And Bruce Buffett and I have been working toward that for a few years now, but I definitely invite other people to consider that. So now, in the end, I hope to still be doing science, so I'm going to give you some fairly specific hypotheses, which are each refutable, so I may be wrong on any of these, which I welcome the possibility. But first, I would suggest that any system with a sufficiently small Ekman number, and I'll put the number right at about 10 to the minus 6, are oscillatory, somewhat independent of Rossby number. The Rossby number needn't be small for this to be true. Now, most simulations that are done are not in this range. I understand it's relatively difficult to get to very small Ekman numbers, although this is right about at the edge of what can be done currently. And when you're in this range, that the sort of power law scalings of wave number spectra or frequency spectras that one likes to use as simple models are simply no longer appropriate to understand the dynamics that happen in those systems. And then, in fact, you have a wave turbulence or structured spectra having to do with the modes of the container and probably various selection rules of how those particular modes are being driven. And moreover, I would expect that there would be consequences to dynamos operating in a rapidly rotating system due to the fact that you're not in this broadband regime, but you have a very structured system, relatively speaking. So second, that the high RM limit, or RM going to infinity limit, can be modeled as a let's say, toy model by superfluid helium, but that suggests that you really need to think about, as has been done somewhat, about a competition between generation and reconnection. And just thinking about dissipation as the loss mechanism that is a diffusive process is perhaps not at the heart of what happens at very large magnetic Reynolds number. And then finally, that the magnetorotational instability or Velikov instability and shear instabilities are not mutually exclusive. And so the lengthy arguments in astrophysics about whether it's one or the other perhaps miss the point that it may be both. And so, you know, if you will, they both may play a role in many astrophysical situations, and we might become more relaxed on this point over time. And also, I guess some of the states we've seen have been hysteretic, and I encourage all of you that have been looking at linear onsets to think about also probing for different hysteretic states, as I know some of you have and some of you haven't. I guess there are reprints illegally posted to some of these papers at the group website, as well as some videos and otherwise. And just for an update, I guess we've been in construction of an experiment five times larger. This is a 3-meter diameter experiment, which Santiago Triana's and Dan Zimmerman, actually here and here, together with Don, been working on. So this will also be spherical Quet flow. The experiment is mechanically complete. It's currently filled with water. And we've been starting to take data in water and also just debugging all the systems before loading with 13.5 tons of sodium in the end. We have about 700 kilowatts of motive power for the two spheres. And so far, things have been going very well, other than the fact it takes an enormous amount of time to build enormous experiments. So the system spins smoothly. All 34 tons of it, actually, mechanically, things are going very well. The diagnostics are coming along. It is possible, but not certain, that we will be loading with sodium this fall. But, you know, as with any hazardous experiment, one needs to take it one step at a time. Oh, those were just talk. In fact, you can't hear the bearings at all. When the system's rotating under power, what you can hear is the belt. It's got a timing belt off the top that hums. One of the surprises we had in setting up the system is we expected to have to balance it. And we found out that as built, it was balanced up to at least 1.25 hertz that we've run without needing any additional balance. And I guess with that, I'll end. Thank you.
Dan, regarding your second conclusion, and in fact, with Carlo Barenghi and Andrew Bagley in Newcastle, we pursued this idea further, this analogy, and we now have a model of small-scale dynamo action, which relies on reconnections rather than diffusion operator. And the result is that the growth rate is significantly higher, and the energy release rate is significantly higher than with the induction equation. But our model relies very heavily on a simple model of reconnection, where magnetic lines just reconnect, well, forcefully in our code. Do you have any insight from your experiments about the mechanics or dynamics of reconnection of vortex lines? What are the timescales involved? Are there any topological constraints on that from the experiment?
So a couple of comments come to mind. I guess the one is that in making this particular suggestion, to a certain extent, what comes to mind are Vinon-type models, where one thinks about generation and reconnection-driven dissipation models that could be written as a spatial dependence. And I guess I'd be interested to hear more about what your and Carlo's work. We've done quite extensive work at understanding the reconnection process in this context. And it's a scale-independent process, so there are exponents involved, and so there's no particular scale involved. Those exponents are tied to the particular dynamics underlying the system, which is Gross-Pitievsky. And it's not obvious that one could write down a model, although not obvious that you couldn't, where Gross-Pitievsky also governed magnetic field dynamics in a highly magnetized plasma. I think that's an interesting thing to think about further. If not, then there would be other dynamical consequences involved, and in particular, the Alphane velocity is a dimensionally relevant parameter for magnetic reconnection, I've come to learn, and I'm just been learning from my plasma colleagues more and more about magnetic reconnection. I think that a lot of the work currently being done in magnetic reconnection, not all, but most of the work being done, is quasi-steady or 2D reconnection in a way that's very interesting, but probably very different than what happens in an intermittent turbulent magnetic tangle. And so I think that's something that we as a community, or the multiple communities, might want to think about in greater detail, and I think there are interesting experiments to contemplate as well on that. I don't know what the scalings are, but I think that's something we could learn.
Okay, I think at the back there, yeah. Just a question about your conclusion on the mixing of shear and MRI instabilities. I'm not sure I understood. In your first spherical quad flow setup, do you have a linearly stable profile from the hydrodynamic point of view? Or the second one is close to Keplerian, you said, but the first one, the one you presented before, what is it exactly? I didn't catch it.
So I guess the first set of spherical Couette data that I showed you was over an extremely wide range of rotation rate ratios, and some of those rotation rate ratios are Rayleigh unstable and some are not. Mm-hmm. Probably all have a certain amount of shear instability built into them. At 10 million magnetic Reynolds numbers, they're going to be finite onset turbulent states. But the surprising fact is the fact we get these large-scale oscillatory patterns, which are living on top of these other instabilities that are well developed by the time we spin the experiment up for 2 seconds.
And so the second point is, because you have boundaries and because you have shear layers, then you would expect that you get shear instabilities, which might not be the case for some astrophysical objects where you don't get these kind of boundaries. I'm thinking about the case of accretion disk, for instance, where you would expect that the profile is well established and you wouldn't get any sort of inflection points or whatever, or shear layer.
Well, I think it's important to understand that inertial modes are not, or inertial waves are not a property of the boundary, but are a property of the bulk. Now, if you then put them in a container or give them boundaries, then one gets modes. But that it's just a question of which waves are present or not present. It's really just the presence of Coriolis acceleration and pressure will give an essential wavy nature as long as those modes are underdamped and are able to tap into some source of free energy.
So as you probably know, with inflation, the $64 million question in reconnection is the scaling with magnetic Reynolds number. And I mean, so with your liquid helium analogy, ultimately the quantum mechanical dynamics of the vortex core must assert itself in the reconnection event. And so that would be, in some sense, the analog, shall we say, of not in the physics, but in terms of the question, the scaling dependency. Can you say in that sense, how fast is the reconnection that you are observing? In other words, to what power is it dependent on the quantum mechanical vortex core properties?
It's a good but complicated question. I think that there are in fact at least two different asymptotic regimes in time that one has to consider in this question in our system, or perhaps in the magnetized plasma case. If one thinks of highly localized flux tubes of either vorticity or magnetic field, then there's going to be one process when they're actually in contact with each other, which is associated, our quantum mechanical processes only happen in that case, and the cores are of angstrom size, and so that happens around time scales or velocity scales associated with the speed of sound. Once they've reconnected, then one goes over into another intermediate asymptotic, whereby the retraction process and the acceleration process is independent of the local process by which you change topology.
Fair enough, but there is, in both cases, going to be something like a helicity conservation constraint. In one case, magnetic, in the other case, hydrodynamic. And in other words, I think you made the point earlier of laminar versus turbulent. First of all, there have been thoughts given, maybe not by your colleagues in Maryland, to the question of turbulent reconnection as widely studied. But in both cases, these sort of topological conservation laws over the region of the reconnection event assert themselves.
Not wanting to comment on theory, which I am not qualified to comment on, I would say that by far, from my point of view, the most interesting experiments that have dealt with this issue directly have been the experiments of Paul Bellen, where he collided pairs of arcs out of a pair of guns, and the results of that reconnection process depended on the relative helicity of the two arcs in a somewhat explosive way, which I think deserves more consideration.
Pardon, Monsieur?
Yes, in your MRI instability, you start with a Keplerian profile, then you have the instability, and how is the profile modified once the instability has set in?
It tends to flatten.
Okay, I think Henri Claude is next, actually. Yeah.
Again, for this Velikov MRI instability, what you find is a mode with this equatorial dipole. You don't find the asymmetric mode, right?
Well, we do, but at a slightly higher Lundquist number. So, in fact, the axisymmetric state we see is the second state as we increase the magnetic field. The first state we see is this equatorial dipole.
Okay, and you have any idea why that is so compared to the theoretical predictions?
Well, having spoken to Edgar Knobloch about this, his comment to me was that if you have a base state which is, SO2 cross Z2, I guess, and it's in the base state symmetry, that you're either going to get a reflection breaking bifurcation or an azimuthal breaking bifurcation, and as far as he's concerned, flip a coin as to which it's going to be. Obviously, we're not in an infinite cylinder. But in that case, also, then one can break one of those two symmetries. But in fact, if you can have very long k's, then that affects your ability to softly break that one, I suppose. Our cylinder is, of course, very short and somewhat spherical.
Yuri, I think next.
Could you perhaps speak about the power of soft iron? You've had a month to think about that soft iron makes dynamos a little bit more feasible. Could you understand? Have you come to some understanding of why, what's involved?
I don't have a very good understanding, but I have some intuition that may be true or false. What's clear for the spherical case is that when we magnetize our soft iron sphere with our external coils, you get only about a factor of 2 gain in the magnetic field adjacent to our soft iron inner sphere. That's actually the limit of infinitely large mu for a linear paramagnetic material. And so I think that's not merely it. So it can't just be the fact that mu gives you some gain in the magnetic field, because if we're seeing 10 times larger induced magnetic fields and 10 to 50 times larger torques, that's not enough of an explanation. And so, what I've come to imagine what's happening, especially because of these extremely large torques that have induced themselves in our system, is that you're getting something like magnetic baffles that are being anchored in this material, perhaps due to the boundary condition. So it may be that the boundary condition is the more important thing in the system and not the existence as a gain material. And so you could imagine that if you start getting an equatorial dipole, it becomes very rigid nearby the boundary of the soft iron, and then is able to entrain fluid in a way that's as if you literally put a baffle out into the fluid. Whether or not this assists in understanding the Katarash results is far from clear. So one must think about, if it's that, in what way the particular geometry around these blades is enabling the magnetic fields to extend their influence out from the surface itself deeper into the fluid, effectively giving you larger coupling into the system than you might have otherwise. But again, this is imagination, not necessarily science yet.
All right.
I think it's useful to make a distinction between two types of reconnection that can be going on. One is if you have a system which you force, it's turbulent, you force it at an outer scale, for example, the magnetic field builds up smaller scale structures, and on the very smallest scale, you have dissipation. The time scale to get the energy down to that scale is the overturn timescale for the scale in which you force. And the reconnection rate or whatever would just determine the nature of the structures that you develop in the steady state to accommodate the input forcing rate. That would be different, say, from the problem where you perturb two oppositely magnetized field lines in a non-turbulent flow, give it a perturbation, and ask how long does that take to reconnect. So in the problems where they're forced, when you say the high RM limit states, I think if the problem is forced, the limit state would refer not necessarily to the time scale of evolution of larger scale structures, but to the spectrum of structures that have developed. So if the reconnection rate is slow on the very small scales, you would pile up to smaller scales before you could accommodate the input driving rate. If the reconnection rate is fast, you would get less of the small scales. But the overall rates on the larger scales may not really be sensitive to the reconnection rate if you're driving the system continuously.
I think, right, what I was suggesting was definitely the former, not the latter, of the two cases you were talking about. And your comment actually brings to mind a question which would be familiar to the hydrodynamicists, that is, if reconnection is the thing that's balancing generation for a statistical steady state, the process by which reconnection happens in a highly magnetized plasma may be relevant in its dimensions, or maybe a sort of singular limit by which it really doesn't matter how the reconnection's happening, because it's happening remotely from the input mechanism. And those two situations, of course, have very different scalings and are discernible in principle.
Okay, thank you, Dan. I think that's it. We can move on to the next talk.
And the next talk is actually